Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I guess I can't say, as always, joined by Max Montana, because he's off coaching some powerlifting right now. But I am joined by today's guest, Aaron Thomas, coach of the incomparable Jen Milliken. How you doing, buddy?
Doing well. How are you doing today?
And we are here at USA Powerlifting Raw Nationals. As you can see, USAPL, you're welcome for the free advertising on the Jug Life Podcast. I'll expect a little bit faster press commands than we got last night in exchange. So Aaron is a master in sport physiology and coaching from ETSU, Eastern Tennessee State University, the same place that Dr. Israetel, Dr. Hoffman received their PhDs from. So a lot of similar influences and everything.
Absolutely, similar influences, then having the chance to actually work together with him on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah.
In fact, Mike was a workout partner of mine for year and a half or so. So,
how many towels does it take to wipe down a bench that Israetel's just glazed over?
You just walk away.
Yeah.
Just let somebody else get it.
You get like a hair dryer out, blow that down for a while.
Pick off the back hair. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You need some kind of like a what that sticky Swiffer.
There you go.
Yeah. Swiffer, ShamWow, and now you're based at Knoxville, Tennessee, right?
Yes, sir.
So I've had the fortune to compete in the highest prestige powerlifting meets, SPF Pro-Ams, in the Days Inn Ballroom in Knoxville, Tennessee. Are you familiar?
I am familiar.
Yes. spectacular. Glitz and glamour. That was my second powerlifting meet. And I've never been back to Knoxville since. I don't know if I'm even allowed back. Had a great meet. 21.65 at 308. Was at the time the number two 308 total in the world, which really is a testament to how far powerlifting has come. And then some Knoxville natives, they wanted to get smart with me at a bar called Losers. You know that one?
I don't know if it's still there anymore, okay. Unfortunately. Well,
they probably had to burn it down. But I put the juggernaut to work on someone, and I never saw him stand up. So
there you go.
I was just happy to get to the airport the next day, get out of the jurisdiction of the Knoxville PD.
Probably for the best. Yeah. Definitely using your head the right way, though. I like it.
So where'd you do your undergrad at?
So as actually at ETSU as well.
Okay. I got some ETSU stories. I got in a lot of trouble in Tennessee.
I like ETSU stories.
Yeah.
So always some interesting stuff.
Poor Richards,
great spot.
Great spot. Poor Richards in Johnson City, Tennessee. Fantastic drink specials, like dollar you call it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
On a pretty regular basis.
Yeah. Like, it's Tuesday, dollar you call it.
And then
it's a day that ends in Y. Here's some really cheap booze.
You get a lot of unlimited beer specials as well for 3 hours. I think I'm trying to make animal hours, what they call it.
You have to take that as a personal challenge.
All you can drink for like 2 hours, and then it never turns out well. And they figured it out after, I don't know, 20 years or so.
Yeah, that's bad. It's bad for everyone involved.
Absolutely.
So as you look at your master's experience and deciding to forego the PhD, like that pretentious asshole Israetel, if you were to give some advice to maybe students, you know, in their undergrad or thinking about a career in strength and conditioning, what do you think was great about your experience and maybe some things you'd change?
So first of all, ETSU, the experience at ETSU for a strength and conditioning coach is unlike anything else. As a master's student, you actually get to work with a team. You get assigned to a team. So I was working with primarily men's tennis while I was in my grad school. When I was an undergrad, I was an assistant strength and conditioning coach for men's soccer. So now, you know, coming out of school, coming out of my master's degree, I've already got 4 years of D1 coaching experience. As far as I know, ETSU is still one of the only places in the country that actually you get a team, you're a strength and conditioning coach while you're working on your master's degree or your PhD. So that was a huge leg up on a lot of other schools. As you know, as a strength and conditioning coach, even at D1 levels, if you're not at a major school, you're looking at 100 hours a week and $35,000 a year.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a strength and conditioning coach. paying off a PhD on a $35,000 a year salary, not going to work. So that was kind of one of the reasons why I didn't really look at getting my PhD. And actually, I want to as kind of like a retirement plan, just something to do, because I can't stop working. I'm a guy, I like to stay busy. I like to do things. I like to learn. So eventually I want to go on and get a PhD just so I have the opportunity to learn more and kind of apply myself to one topic area and just really, really dig in. That's something I've always wanted to do, and then go back and teach it in school because I enjoy teaching. But for now, as a coach, to me, it didn't really make sense to go get a PhD if I plan to be a coach. I said, you know, I stopped the strength and conditioning route for the same reason, like $35,000 a year, 100 hours a week, just didn't make sense for me.
It is. It's a Spartan nomadic existence where you move from place to place, you know, and as Jug Life listeners and watchers know, we've had several strength and conditioning coaches on recently, Frank Wintrick from UCLA, Corey Schlesinger at Stanford, and so many of these guys are telling the stories of, you know, I was at this school for 9 months and I was here for 14 months and you know, they've been at 8 schools in 10 years kind of thing to move up the ladder and maybe, you know, get that one elusive, like a amazing job like Coach Wintrick has at UCLA now and those kind of jobs, but they're few and far between.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, you have a coach or you're, so you primarily work with football players. Your head coach gets fired because he sucks.
Yeah.
You may be the best strength and conditioning coach in the world. Doesn't matter. And I didn't want to rely so heavily on that and then have to extend my career for actually paying off my student loans for the next 20 years. I didn't want to have to do that. So I got into, I actually ended up going into medical sales, which is, you know, a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but it's something that I've been able to do. Control my schedule quite a bit and then pick up my coaching online more because I've coached online for about 10 years. And then trying to dig into it a little more and really pick up that business for the last probably 4 years. And then for the last 6 months to a year, I've been really amping up even more. So I've, you know, roughly doubled my client base in the last, roughly the last year and just trying to push that direction.
So before we get into a little bit more talk about that, just to kind of wrap up the education stuff, you know, you mentioned being a D1 strength coach while you're getting your master's at ETSU. And it's important for people listening to understand that a sport physiology and coaching degree is very unique in the, you know, higher education field, that often it's exercise physiology and people go to school wanting to do, you know, to be a strength and conditioning coach or to own a private facility or whatever it is. But then they go get an exercise physiology degree and learn about, you know, how to work with the elderly and obese and stuff. So if it is something that you want to do is to work with athletes, sport physiology, coaching, being put in those positions is so hugely important because there's a lot of these programs that don't teach you how to coach. And that was a big reason why my degree is in history, because I knew that there weren't many programs out there.
Right.
You know, growing up in Southern California, I wasn't like, oh yeah, Johnson City, let's go move there for a while. Though we did visit a couple times for track meets.
Right. With ETSU especially, the primary focus is on sport physiology. So everything in the curriculum is, you know, we learn the exercise science obviously, but it's all about application and how to apply it to your athletes. And I mean, it's a huge step up. If you go to, you know, you have exercise science in undergrad and you start learning that and you realize really quickly that it's, if you want to be a coach, it doesn't apply really much at all to anything that you ever want to do. So actually taking the sport physiology classes, you know, Dr. Mike Stone was one of my professors. He's head of the department. And
the most published American sports scientist, right? Like 250 some research journal articles.
Yeah, his curriculum vitae is just absolutely insane. And then you also get the pleasure of working with his wife, Meg Stone, who is, I think she still holds the collegiate record for shot put and discus, I believe.
Yeah, NCAA record holder, University of Arizona, shot discus, Meg Ritchie at the time.
First female head strength conditioning coach in Arizona. So she's pretty impressive. There's actually, I guess when I was in my undergrad, she was, she got upset with her throwers one day. And if you ever see Meg is a very frail looking lady now. She's pretty thin. She's a little tall, but she's pretty thin. And she picked up a shot put.
If you saw her throwing pictures, she was not frail.
No, not at all. Tank. She was absolutely, I think, There's a joke, I don't know if it's true or not, maybe it is, but that she got her head strength coach job from being able to out squat all the guys on the football team. And if you see her from the pictures from those days, it's absolutely believable. But she got pissed off at the weightlifters for, you know, or the throwers for not giving their 100% effort or not doing things right. And as I don't know how old she is, but she's, like I said, she's fairly frail looking, especially compared to a thrower. There's no comparison there now. She picks up and out throws the ETSU record and just turns around and keeps going back to work. And it's something absolutely amazing. And just, I don't know how that happens without the muscle mass being there anymore, but just shows you how much technique
when
is
involved.
When
you got it, you got it.
It's, yeah. She has it.
So you said you've been doing a lot of online coaching for 10 years. So you're a pretty early adopter in that field and working a lot with bodybuilders at the time, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it's all started with T-Nation. Learned a lot of stuff online. It's the best place of information that you could possibly ever have.
In the early 2000s, they had great articles.
They actually had some solid stuff.
Yeah, and these are like Charlie Francis articles and
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, there was actually a lot of good coaches and still names you still see now. Like Schoenfeld was doing articles for them back then as well, yeah. I think. I mean, a lot of really good researchers that actually posted, but there's still a lot of BS to kind of tread through. But I was a personal trainer actually while I was in high school still. So I did fairly well read as much as you could be at that time in high school. And I had a lot of clients that I wanted to take with me to ETSU, moving 4 hours away. Obviously, that's impossible to do. So I'm trying to find a way to continue to work with them. And it was started off just like email. I'm going to email you a program. Then you started getting into Excel a little more and start sending them Excel files. And that's how my online coaching began. It was just trying to keep clients for a longer period of time, especially when I was in college, not making any money. You know, I had a meal plan. That was cool. So it was like free food during the day. I'd eat everything I could and like my two meals a day, just try to pack it all in. But, you know, I had no extra money to spend on anything. So that was like my little bit of side income. So if I ever wanted to go to a bar and get a couple of beers, I could actually go out and meet people or have friends, because I live in a dome.
In Johnson City, going out to get a beer is like $2 all you can drink. So
it's not like these $8 beers out in California. So it's not too bad. You can do it off of, you know, one or two clients a month. But that's kind of how it all started for me. And then did that for a while, working primarily with bodybuilders. Mostly, you know, I'd give a ton of free programs to friends. That's how everybody starts off, right? Mm-hmm. People, you know, friends that see you, you're in pretty good shape. Let's beg you for a program. And it's cool, you know, to help them out. Did that for a long time. And then slowly started, okay, well, now it's time for me to start monetizing this a little bit, because it's too much of my time not to. And that's how I started off getting into it. It was mostly powerlifters for a long time. And the retention's a little tough there, so it's hard, especially social media as it is now, it's not the same 10 years ago or eight years ago.
Like totally Instagram, world.
Instagram wasn't a thing. So there was really no way to really get your name out there other than just word of mouth. And I was living in Miami, training clients in East Tennessee, so word of mouth is not really easy to come by. So not until I moved back to Tennessee, and then started working with powerlifters a little bit more. Fun story is Jennifer Milliken's actually my first ever powerlifting client, which is...
Nowhere to go but down from there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I peaked really early. And it's funny, as I started coaching her, and you think you can write me a powerlifting program. I'm like, yeah, it's no problem. It's essentially, like, from a periodization standpoint, it's the reverse of bodybuilding. There's not too much different. You just, instead of like 3, 5s, 8s, 10s, 12, whatever, it's just taking that the other direction. And, you know, same rules apply. It's just specificity towards the end, obviously. That's how I did it and set it up. And I got lucky enough to put 25 pounds on her bench in 3 months, I think. And then hit a bunch of squat records or squat PRs really quickly. And the rest is kind of history. And then she blew up, put 250 pounds on her total. And now we're here today. So
let's talk a little bit more about some of your principles in regards to how you set up programming for powerlifting. You said that female powerlifters are particularly kind of a niche that you tend to work with a lot. What may the biggest differences jumping out to you programming for female athletes compared to male athletes?
So one of the reasons I like working with females, it's honestly, it's a bit of a cop-out. I get a wider range of intensities that I can still do okay with. If you get a guy, they're much more sensitive to intensities or high-lit intensities. So they go just a little bit too high and they snap in half and all their numbers go to shit. With females, you have a lot broader range of effective training volumes and intensities, in my opinion, particularly with smaller females. So you get much larger range. I found over the years that Westside still has a really powerful influence on powerlifting, despite not being geared lifters, not taking geared, all the different things. But you found a little, really low volume intensity.
I found it, you know, as I travel around and do seminars all over the country, that the Tennessee area probably more influenced by that. Tennessee, Ohio, you know, I saw a couple Most Wanted posters of myself throughout Ohio. And into the Northeast, like we've done some stuff in Buffalo, and where geared lifting is still a bit more prominent, it's probably even a bigger deal locally there.
Yeah, I think it's probably just because Tennessee as a whole tends to be a little bit behind the times on things. So
I was surprised when you said that they had email 10 years ago.
Right, but, well, it's, yeah. Not many people. There's had some really high-class clients that really ahead of the times.
Audiobooks are a great sidekick for summer activities like hiking, laying out at the beach, training, road tripping, just hanging out outside, and more. Listening is way better way to binge content you love while doing things you love. And Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your summers with more stories. I just finished up Shoe Dog, the Phil Knight memoir, which was excellent. The Tiger Woods book was very, very entertaining all summer. I'm currently listening to Conscious Coaching by Brett Bartholomew. A lot of great content available on there. Audible helps you listen to more books by letting you switch seamlessly between devices, picking up exactly where you left off. Whether it's on your phone, through your car, from a tablet, or at home on an Amazon Echo, you can get tons of books, hands and eyes free, while doing almost anything. Audible members get a credit every month good for any audiobook in their store, regardless of price. Any unused credits roll over for the next month. Didn't like your audiobook? You can exchange it, no questions asked. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. Start a 30-day trial, and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/juglife or text juglife to 500-500, and you can do it with audiobooks.
Yeah, so it's... So where are we going? We're talking about starting off really broad. So specificity is not very high. So we're talking, you know, squat, bench, deadlift, any variation of that. Slowly towards a meet, getting closer to, like, say, if they're a low bar squatter, moving towards a low bar. If they're a conventional deadlifter, we're doing almost exclusively conventional. Instead of having, like, hyperextensions, for instance, we are tapering everything towards much more specificity. Start off with higher volumes, higher reps, slowly work your way down to lower reps, singles. So hypertrophy, strength, and then power peaking, which, depending on the athlete that you're working with. So that's... And it's really funny, honestly, before I'd ever read any of your stuff, I'd been working with Jennifer for a little while. I mean, I came across, like, Juggernaut articles, but not really, I hadn't read anything about the Juggernaut training method. And, you know, I'm writing my programs out, and I'm looking at it, and then I see that the Juggernaut training method, I think it was, like, 1.0, whatever your first rendition of that was.
Way back.
Yeah. So it's, but I look at it, it's very, very similar. And I think when you take the principle of strength training and apply them correctly, those programs should almost all look similar. As long, I mean, it was, if you're using like typical like block periodization, there's not going to be too much difference. I mean, it's the principles are the principles for a reason, and that's kind of what I've always stuck to.
So when you say high volume, that can mean there's a big range of what that can mean. What's some high volume stuff, like actual sets and reps that maybe Jen has had, because I'm sure people are going to, they may have a conception of what high volume is, right? And what you're about to say is probably far beyond that.
So with Jennifer in particular, this would be a typical squats. I've changed the training up a little bit more to be somewhat more of a DUP style, not quite DUP, but a little more in that direction. But previously, say we're squatting twice a week, and we'll start off with 3x6 squats at fairly high intensity. We're talking about 7, 8, 9 RPE from week to week, and then dropping down and doing sets of 8 to 10 on squats as well, and then doing some form of a hip hinge, whether it be another lighter deadlift or any like double hyperextension, something like that.
Yeah.
Good mornings. Do a lot of good mornings. Or used to do a lot of good mornings. I know she loves that. For anywhere between 4 to 5 sets of 8 to 10, depending on the week, for a high volume, and then dropping down and either doing one more quad emphasis work, whether it be lunges for somewhere five sets of 10 plus, or just like front squats. Doing 5x10 after all that on front squats is absolutely brutal.
So, but yeah, 3x6 in the squat, and then how many sets maybe of 8x10 after that?
3 to 4, usually, up to 5.
So three to five sets of 8x10 after that, and then some RDLs or good mornings,
yep,
or something?
Yeah, some 4 to 5 sets there.
4 to 5 sets of RDLs after that, then up to 5 sets of...
Front squats or usually lunges.
Yeah.
Something. We try not to load the spine too much. Just recovery gets too difficult. But
you guys do the belt squat much?
Unfortunately, I don't think Wade has access to a belt squat now, but I want to. I saw Mike Tashier doing it the other day with a
rope
underneath.
Yeah, a lot of creative ways to get it going. Yeah, so to kind of echo Aaron's point there, you know, with some of my lifters like Marissa, Kristen Dunsmore, yeah, Marissa's done 11 sets of 6 in like a high bar squat. I mean, five sets or 6 sets of high bar squat with 5 sets of 6 front squat. After that, 3 sets of split squats and then something like a back raise after that is one session. And then a second session similar to that later in the week, about 75% as much volume. So maybe 7 sets of 6 on the squats instead of 11 sets of 6. And just cutting a set or two off of the smaller exercises.
Yeah, that's fairly similar, except on that second day of the week for me, we're replacing some of that squat volume with deadlift volume. So the volume for hers wasn't really dropping. It was all based on what she was actually being able to recover from. Mm. And I started off a little more conservative than that. Basically, the RPEs changed. So keeping the volume fairly high, but went from 6, 7, 8 RPE or 7, 8, 9. Found out that really quickly that she could recover very, very well.
Yeah.
Just programming numbers instead of RPEs, and she just kept hitting them. So if she continues to hit them and she's hitting them with quality reps, then I know that she's capable of it. The recovery is not necessarily too much of an issue yet. So cranked it up, and eventually she was getting to like 7, 8, 9, 10 RPE on we said 13 sets of squats or so, I mean, in a single session, which...
Yeah.
It's amazing. If I did that, I mean, I would snap in half now.
Sure. And that's the takeaway, as Aaron said, as much as she can recover from, as much as Jen can recover from, I'm talking about as much as Marissa can recover from. That's not necessarily what you, the listener, or the athletes that you coach can recover from, but just trying to give a frame of reference when you think of high-volume training, what is potentially possible. I always, you know, look back at a time when I started working with Josh Bryant early in my powerlifting career, and the first program he sent me, I called him back and was like, is this a fucking joke? Like, you expect me to do this in one day? And the culmination of it was like a heavy triple in the deadlift with 10 sets of 4 back down sets on 1 minute rest periods, and then a couple sets of 6 deficit deadlifts, 5 sets of bent over rows, 5 sets of GHRs, 5 sets of chin-ups, 5 sets of back raises. And it was like a 2.5 hour just brutalizing of my body. And if you would have told me 3 weeks before that I could have survived it, let alone benefited from it, I would have thought you were crazy. But you know, hearing some of those numbers for Jen that Aaron's saying Jen's doing and what Marissa does, like hopefully that can kind of open some eyes to when you want to talk about training high volume, what high volume can really mean.
Yeah, and high volume is not necessarily that difficult to recover from. It's the combination of the high volume and the intensity. And you talk to a lot of bodybuilders, and they'll hear that same program and think that's not very high volume. I was talking to a guy the other day. He said, you know, a session for him should be 500 reps or more. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it, I was like, I can't think of the last time I've had any of my lifters do 500 reps. Like, I can't imagine why we would ever need to do that.
Yeah, we get...
huge frame of reference there. It's completely different depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, we have all those hypertrophy guide videos with Dr. Mike, and inevitably in the comments, Mike talks about a MRV of 22 sets for whatever body part or something, and then people in the comments, well, I do 30 sets per workout. I do that twice a week. And it's like, well, your sets are probably light as shit.
Or it's isolation movements. Like, you're gonna recover a lot easier from 30 sets of tricep extensions than you are with 30 sets of bench press.
Yeah.
It's not even close to the same, and there's a lot of people who don't understand that. So that's something to adjust for and something to pay attention to. The worst I've ever seen volume wise is actually working out with Mike. We did a workout. For me at the time, I was probably right around a 500 pound squat, and I hit 365 for 987. I think 9876. Dropped down to 315 for 10.9864, and then dropped to 275 and was at 12, and then we dropped to 225 and hit. That was for four sets at 275 and five sets at 225. And then we walked over and we did a superset. Actually, we did some good morning somewhere in the middle there. I have no idea where they're at.
Blacked out,
yeah,
for a while.
It's four to five sets there. And then go and do 225 again on squats for, I think I hit like 18 on the first set down to, that's where I started off. 225 with that, superset with hack squats at 225, walk back over, no breaks, just walking from machine to machine or machine to squat. 135 for max reps to 135 on hack squat max reps. Dropped it, bar for max reps, the whatever the machine is on hack squat, like 45 pounds for max reps, and then did just straight body weight squats. And I got seven at that point where I just couldn't physically stand up after seven reps, and Mike got 2.5. That was the highest, most ridiculous volume I've ever done. And
sounds terrible.
I thought I was going to die. We laid in the floor for, I think, like 35 minutes. All the volleyball players are walking in like, what are these guys laying in a pile of their own vomit for?
Well, at least they weren't in there when they saw you fail on your seventh bodyweight squat. That would have been the exact time that they walk in.
Yes.
Bunch of tall, pretty volleyball girls, little shorts, and as you barely stand up, you're like, seven, and then you just fall over.
Collapse, yeah.
It's a good look. In high school, doing like a... these really long drop sets on the bench where you put, you know, all these tens on at the start, and you're going and stripping them and going and stripping them, and then you get to the empty bar and you're like,
and then the pretty girl walks in.
Exactly. Inevitably, that's the time they come in. So you look at Jen as a lifter and a competitor, and she's been so successful, three USAPL national championships, two world championships, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And what do you think are some things besides, obviously, the ability to tolerate high volume and recover high volume and intensity combinations, some things that have made her so successful?
All right, so with Jen, the things that honestly made her so successful, in my opinion, obviously there's a genetic component where she's just naturally strong. So when we started working together, she'd only been powerlifting for a year and a half, 2 years, and she already had an elite total. So obviously she's gifted in that department. But she is absolutely the most focused athlete I've ever worked with, period. I've worked with at least 250 NFL players in some capacity, and I've never worked with a single player ever that's been anywhere near as dedicated in every aspect of their life. I get texts from Jen literally every day at 4, 5, 6 times a day asking questions about powerlifting or something to do with powerlifting. And she's just so incredibly focused, and I've never seen anybody who can do that for as long a period as she has and then stay consistent. Usually a high rate of burnout when you have somebody like that. You can see it for short periods of time. They compete, and then they deload, and then they stop talking. They stop communicating. They're gone because they just completely destroyed themselves, like just mentally and emotionally. Happens a lot with bodybuilders, especially as they start getting lean. It's very mentally demanding, so there's that aspect.
That's why I've never done it. I can't handle the mental aspect of it.
It really is brutal, and there's nothing else to say about it. I wouldn't recommend it on anybody. So just the fact that being able to stay singularly focused like that, and even with like every time she eats, like every piece of food that she puts in her mouth, it's a calculated risk. Like she knows that that's what's going to happen. That's one of the reasons why she wouldn't move to 63, is to actually think about powerlifting less. Uh-huh. Because every time she eats and she's having to control her diet, she knows that the reason she's having to do that is because she has to make weight at 57, and it's going to directly affect her results. So she actually has taken a little bit of a break by going to 63, she's very coachable. You ask her to do something, she does it. She has this weird switch that she can flip on. It's a switch that you want your athletes to be able to do when it's game time and it's time to do it. She does it, and you can see it. So she doesn't really like to be talked to on game day too much. So you just see her quiet, and you think she's in the zone. And I'll never forget, like at the last World Championships, she goes, "Can I win?" And it's just, you have to hit this to win. Period. You don't hit this, you don't win. And instantly just, you can see in her eyes, it's just, there's a change that happens and it's time to go. And then she walks out there and she lifted it for 10 seconds and she had the nice little hair puff thing, if you know what I'm talking about. She rewatched that video like 20 times. But yeah, it's just there's a switch, and you hope that your athlete can do that, and she's just the one who just continues to do that. She has to be driven, so she likes being the underdog too, which is exciting, especially about coming up tonight. So, yeah.
So as you look at that, the psychological aspect of powerlifting, maybe some advice you have for people out there to better develop themselves in that area.
So the main thing is just visualizing your attempts or visualizing your lifts. And that, you can practice that. All it is have to be on meet day. And that's one mistake that I see people making. You know, they get in the zone one time for each lift, but it's only on meet day. And you can have a chance to practice that every single day. It doesn't mean you have to get overhyped for a lift. I usually don't recommend that in training, just so you don't get your intensity too high and you can actually recover. But you still have the ability to focus on a lift, see it in your head, visualize it 2, 3, 4 times. I mean, you've got, you know, most powerlifters are taking like 5-plus minutes between sets anyway. So you have time to really visualize it, and you can stay calm and relaxed. The other thing is, like, getting overhyped for a powerlifting meet. I mean, we just had a meet yesterday here, obviously. I think we were competing for 7 hours, something like that. It was a while.
It was pretty long, yeah.
And it was...
Yeah, probably 2 to 8, something, 2 to 8:30.
Yeah, so we're looking at six-plus hours. And you see lifters who are completely in the zone or trying to stay in the zone for all of that.
Yeah.
And there's a huge burnout effect that happens towards the end.
For sure.
It's just, let's just get through these deadlifts. And they can't get to that just truly in the zone again after the end. It's just not the same. So having the ability to get yourself to calm down in between and then get fired back up for the actual lift itself and then bring it back down a notch. So
I think a big part of that too is what being fired up really constitutes. Like it's not necessarily, you know, slapping yourself in the face and putting on this kind of show for your, you know, your Instagram followers or
right.
Whatever. Yeah, it can be this very quiet focus, which in the long term I think is much more effective as well and much more sustainable through long days, because you want to, you know, start blasting ammonia caps for your opening squat, like 6 hours later when it's time to take your third deadlift, what are you going to have left by that time?
So that's a lot of ammonia caps.
Yeah.
But, that's another thing is there's a lot of people on meet day, they try to get overhyped because they're going out there to hit this meet in front of 100 people, 200 people, whatever it is. And just because they're in a competition, they have to hit it. So they do just things that aren't natural for them. Like me, I'm a very calm person, even on my lifts. Like a little bit like Greg Knuckles, like I can be laughing as I unrack the bar for my, you know, like a max effort attempt. Same like L.S. McLean is the same way. He stays calm. He said he used to try to get fired up, but his attempts, like he never did as well when he did that.
Yeah.
Then he started being himself.
Like it was an act.
Yeah. Then he started being himself, you know, acting the same way he did in training every day, and starts hitting huge PRs on the platform. And it's, you just have to find kind of what works for you, and don't try to act like it's you're something you're not, because it just doesn't work. Plus, it's, you know, if you get overhyped, then you start make small mistakes on a squat, or you make just technical issues that you normally would never make, and it's easily preventable, and it's a mistake that a lot of people make. So
for sure. Aaron, where can people learn more from you, learn about you, find your services?
So the best place to find me is on my Instagram. I've got two of them. It's at 1AT Performance. There's another AT Performance, so I'm one, of course. And then at Strengthalytics, and that's Strength A-lytics. There's no A-N. So I found like it's a bad idea to have anal in your name. It gets a lot of the wrong attention, so you can't
have
that.
Would you consider yourself a strength analyst or a strength therapist?
Strength
analrapist?
Analrapist. No, I like looking at I just like looking at a lot of the numbers and playing with them. So you get some nice cool waveforms that you can create and just see how they all interplay and go from there. I want to kind of do a lot of the same things that Garrett Blevins is doing with, we'll call it AI. Some of it's AI, some of it's not. But, you know, taking all the analytics from everything that we do for coaching, and there's a way to, not say automate the process, but to write down all of the logic so that you can have that populated for yourself, and then you can adjust it as you need it.
Actually what I've been working with Garrett on for about the last 6 months.
It's a huge, long process, but I think, everybody says that, you know, training is an art and a science. I say that's bullshit. it's all science. It's just figuring out what the right questions are to ask, because there's something that you see that makes you think, you know, you see something, maybe you don't realize it, that makes you make a certain adjustment. And it's all yeses or nos. It's all science. It's just figuring out what it is. So that's why Strengthalytics became a thing. So that's what that was about.
All right. So this is Aaron Thomas, strength and alropist, in conjunction with Dr. Tobias Funke. So I'm Chad Wesley-Smith, at Chad Wesley-Smith and at Juggernaut Training. You know all the stuff. Subscribe to the YouTube. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Write us something funny or nice. JuggernautCoaching.com for all that other stuff. At Chad Wesley-Smith and at Juggernaut Training, Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Chad.